that everybody that was involved, the passengers that were involved, were from South Carolina.
The NTSB begins investigating the Soldotna crash that killed 10 people. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Stewart Creek 2 fire near Fairbanks expands to nearly 80,000 acres.
When you get that much smoke into the atmosphere, it will actually make its own cumulus clouds.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
As an active senior, your independence is important to you. One of the ways for you to maintain your independence is to reduce your risk of falling. A fall risk assessment can be part of your initial or annual Medicare exam. They'll ask about your vision and review your medications for possible problems. Learn ways to improve balance, strengthen muscles, and reduce hazards at home. Contact your Medicare provider for an appointment. This message in good health is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
A family of five from South Carolina are among the victims in the Soldotna plane crash that left 10 dead. The Antonakos family usually vacation together in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina each summer, but the father of Kimberly Antonakos says his daughter and her family decided to travel to Alaska from their home in Greenville, South Carolina for 10 days this year instead. The children were 16-year-old Olivia, 14-year-old Mills, and 11-year-old Anastasia. Investigators have begun their probe into the crash of a de Havilland DHC-3 Otter that went down shortly after 11 a.m. Sunday at the airport in Soldotna. KBBI's Ariel Van Cleve arrived at the scene yesterday afternoon and has this story.
The fixed-wing aircraft was reportedly engulfed in flames when first responders, including Soldotna police and Alaska State Troopers, arrived on the scene. Trooper spokesperson Megan Peters says firefighters were not able to immediately get to the plane because of the flames. Authorities were able to recover all of the remains of the victims and send them to the state medical examiner's office in Anchorage for positive identification. Soldotna police officer Mark Baristoff says they do have an idea of where the passengers are from.
We believe that everybody that was involved, the passengers that were involved, were from South Carolina. And we're working very closely with the South Carolina authorities to try to identify family members and make confirmation as far as who was here and identification.
The plane went down a little after 11 a.m. Firefighters and police were still combing through the charred remains of the plane a few hours later when I arrived. It was lying on one side of the runway with the tail partially separated from the body of the aircraft. People were standing in the lot next to the runway watching authorities work. Some were crying, while others stood looking shocked. Several vehicles came and went over the course of an hour to catch a glimpse of the wreckage. One man drove up with a dog in the bed of his truck. As he moved closer, he put his hand against his mouth and shook his head. He said he was a friend of the pilot, Radisky Air owner Walter Radisky, but didn't want to say anything else. Other vehicles pulled up. Some people got out and asked for details, but police were not saying anything at that time. It's possible the passengers were either heading to or arriving from Bear Mountain Lodge. It's located in Chinitna Bay at the southern end of Lake Clark National Park. Co-owner Mac McGann says he did have flights scheduled with Radisky Air for that day, but declined to say anything else due to the ongoing investigation. The National Transportation Safety Board has sent investigators from Washington, D.C. to determine what caused the plane to crash and catch fire. According to the National Weather Service, conditions at the time of the crash were cloudy with a temperature of 55 degrees. Winds were out of the west at about 5 miles per hour, and there was visibility of about 10 miles. The plane itself was a de Havilland Canada DHC-3 Otter. That style of aircraft has a maximum capacity of 11 passengers and was built between 1951 and 1967. The DHC-3 Otter is the same type of craft Senator Ted Stevens and four others were killed in a crash near Dillingham in August 2010. At the time, NTSB investigators ruled out any mechanical problems with the plane as the cause. Instead, the report blamed, quote, temporary unresponsiveness on the part of the pilot, Terry Smith. Reporting from Soldotna, with assistance from KBBI's Aaron Selbig, I'm Ariel Van Cleve.
Warm, dry, and windy weather in the Fairbanks area over the weekend stoked the Stewart Creek 2 wildfire, burning east of Eielson Air Force Base. The fire is now nearly 80,000 acres. Richard Hadley is a public information officer with an incident management team from California assigned to the fire. Nearly 700 personnel are battling the blaze. Hadley says that includes 6 hotshot crews, 16 hand crews on the ground, and help from various agencies.
The Department of Defense has 3 Type 1 helicopters, the large Chinook, they've made available to us. And then today we expect to have 2 Black Hawk helicopters from the National Guard here in Alaska. So that kind of cooperation and bringing the necessary resources to bear on the fire is really helping out.
Hadley says crews continue to secure more than 600 homes threatened by the blaze.
We've had crews in there for days taking measures to reduce fuels around the homes and secure them. In some locations, we actually installed water tanks and hose line and sprinkler systems.
Christopher Cox is a forecaster with the National Weather Service in Fairbanks. He says the fire is large enough to make its own weather.
When you get that much smoke into the atmosphere, it will actually make its own cumulus clouds. And so far, we haven't had any lightning strikes or rain from the pyro clouds, but don't expect that in the future either.
On Saturday night, officials held a community meeting to address local concerns regarding the fire. Fort Wainwright Commander Colonel Ron Johnson took the floor. He says despite persistent red flag warnings, the Army moved forward with artillery training that ignited the fire earlier this month. The Army was able to mitigate the blaze until last week.
So it was monitored, smoked up, they hit it again, and then when the fire conditions changed and the weather can change, it flared up. And now we got what we got.
120 adults and 57 children left the Two Rivers and Pleasant Valley communities Sunday following an evacuation notice. But that notice was lifted this afternoon. The communities are still under an evacuation watch. The Alaska Redistricting Board is one step closer to finalizing the state's political boundaries. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez has more on the concept plan released today.
The plan addresses a variety of legal complaints against the interim map that was used for the 2012 election. One of the biggest criticisms of that map was that it linked up communities in the Fairbanks area with a mostly rural district that extended out to the Bering Sea. In the new plan, those areas are separated. The changes to the interior also create an open district covering Healy, Eielson Air Force Base, and more than a dozen Native villages. In Southeast, the plan takes Petersburg out of Juneau's district and pairs it with Sitka and Hoonah. And in Southwest, the Aleutians are linked once again. Those changes also resolve some concerns about the constitutionality of the interim map. What the plan will do to the political makeup of the legislature is unclear. What we do know is it creates one open house district by pitting North Pole Republicans Tammy Wilson and Doug Isaacson against each other. It also creates a new Senate seat in the Mat-Su region, now that Eagle River Republicans Anna Faircloth and Fred Dyson are in the same district. The plan also requires 4 incumbent senators who previously didn't need to run to campaign for re-election. Those are Click Bishop, a Republican from Fairbanks, Lyman Hoffman, a Democrat from Bethel, Peter Michicki, a Republican from Soldotna, and Faircloth. The redistricting board is scheduled to meet on Sunday to discuss its next steps. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the climbers retracing their ancestors' route up Denali 100 years ago describe reaching the summit last month.
It was really cool. It was an awesome summit day. We got some good photos right before the weather started socking in around us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at FNBAlaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
The Coast Guard is investigating a grounding that led to a fuel spill in the western Prince William Sound over the weekend. The Naknek Spirit's starboard fuel tank ruptured when it ran aground Saturday evening in Passage Canal, 6 miles east of Whittier. Coast Guard spokesperson Petty Officer Sean Eggert says the five-person crew was able to transfer the leaking fuel into another tank.
They got the potential 2,000 gallons of diesel down to about 500 gallons. So that saved, you know, that could have possibly saved a whole lot, you know, a much larger mess that our folks would have had to respond to.
Eggert says the Coast Guard launched an MH-60 Jayhawk helicopter crew from Cordova to conduct an overflight of the area. The owner of the 104-foot fishing vessel hired Alaska Shadow to remove the pollution. Eggert says the area was boomed off, but it was ineffective due to the size of the area.
Fortunately, again, the diesel was dispersed due to the waves and kind of broke up. So the spill was basically contained.
The crew was able to refloat the Naknek at high tide and transit back to Whittier. The incident reportedly occurred in a stellar sea lion sensitive area. Eggert says there were no sea lions in the area at the time of the grounding and no injuries were reported. In another earlier tender grounding in southwest Alaska, Magoan Marine divers contracted by the U.S. Coast Guard have been working to seal off fuel vents on the tender Lone Star, which sank near the mouth of the Aygushik River in Bristol Bay a week ago Sunday. John Brown with the Department of Environmental Conservation is part of the Unified Command responding to the Lone Star.
Well, Dan Magone was able to get on the vessel yesterday and worked at plugging the vents that were buried in the mud or in the clay. This is a fairly dangerous operation with the current and everything, so we're just working on it as hard as we can. We have a response vessel over there, so if there is a release, we can start recovering fuel. Again, we're making progress.
An aerial survey flown today noted less fuel sheen in the water than was seen last Friday, but it's still enough to keep the salmon fishing in that section closed. Tim Sands, the area management biologist with the Department of Fish and Game, was on board the flight. He said the department has zero tolerance for oiled fish.
You know, the reputation of Alaska salmon is pristine, and we cannot afford to risk that reputation with an oiled fish. So if there's oil in the water, the fishery's closed.
Diving efforts were expected to continue today and tomorrow, and a salvage vessel is inbound from Dutch Harbor. There's no estimation yet on how much of the roughly 14,000 gallons of fuel on board the Lone Star have leaked into the Aygushik River. The Anchorage Assembly will hear public testimony tomorrow on an ordinance that would cap pay for the city's executive workers. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
Assemblyman Dick Traney says it's about transparency and accountability in local government. Mayor Dan Sullivan says it's about being a mouthpiece for the unions. Traney proposes limiting executive employee pay raises through an ordinance. He explains what it would require the Sullivan administration to do.
Set their salaries so they cannot have any increases without it being tied to the cost of living adjustments for the city of Anchorage.
Earlier this year, the Anchorage Assembly passed a controversial ordinance backed by Mayor Sullivan, which limited the pay and benefits of the city's union workers by tying their pay to the inflation rate. The current proposed ordinance would limit raises for executives by tying their pay to a 5-year average of the Consumer Price Index for Anchorage, plus 1%. It would also address the cost of leave packages that Traney alleges in some cases contain weeks of additional leave and have gone unaccounted for. The Assembly is also expected to hear public testimony on another ordinance introduced by Traney. It would require Assembly approval for any money spent on opinion polls and lobbyists, and lower the amount that the mayor's office could spend on outside attorneys without Assembly approval from $30,000 to $10,000. Traney says that the ordinances are a response to AO 37.
37 was outsourced. They outsourced it to a private attorney, and it came in at $29,500. We weren't told what they were working on until it was already done. this would drop it to $10,000 and require them to specify what they're hiring the attorney to work on.
Sullivan says an internal study of union employees' wages and benefits was conducted before AO 37 was proposed, and he thinks that there should be a study of executive wages and benefits before any changes are made.
The first thing that needs to happen before he delves into an area where really he probably shouldn't be delving is he would probably need to do a compensation study. Let's figure out, before we start limiting their pay, how are they paid compared to other executives in similar positions? And I think that this needs a lot more work before what he's trying to do really is ready for prime time.
Sullivan says he believes extra leave is justified for executive employees since they often work long hours, but in contrast with union employees, don't get paid overtime. And leave awards, he says, are one of the only ways to attract and retain employees. But he says that's for the assembly to decide.
You know, it's petty politics, unfortunately, and but I don't think there's the votes to support any of them going forward anyway, but I guess we'll see what happens.
Earlier this summer, the Assembly passed an ordinance requiring that, in addition to their salary amounts, non-cashable leave and benefits be disclosed for employees who had changes in their compensation in the past quarter. Sullivan says his office plans to disclose that information at Tuesday's regular Assembly meeting. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Anchorage is one of fewer than a dozen communities in the United States where the number of kids who are obese is declining. Between the 2002 and 2010 school years, the obesity rate among students in grades kindergarten through eighth grade fell 3%. Cindy Norquist is program director for Healthy Futures, a statewide initiative to get kids exercising every day. She's in Washington, D.C. this week to share Anchorage's success story in a panel discussion sponsored by the American Cancer Society and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. She says Healthy Futures wants kids to make physical activity a habit in a fun way.
I often say what happens is when Healthy Futures becomes part of a school, that school creates a mini culture where physical activity is the norm, and you see more and more kids, no matter what their shape or size, starting to participate because it's a culture. It's you know, being healthy is kind of what they're surrounding themselves, and they want to continue with that.
Why do you think Anchorage has been able to reduce its childhood obesity rates? What are the most important factors here?
You know, I think the fact that we have a collaborative approach is what's making the difference. And probably one of the greatest pieces, one of the most beneficial pieces that we have is the fact that we now have qualified professionals teaching health outside of the curriculum, the classroom curriculum, so that there's an emphasis on health. And I think when you bring it out to the forefront, people start talking about it.
Why do you think the health specialists in particular that are in the schools now have made such a big difference?
I think, you know, a lot of times when you get the health message, it's really written for adults, whereas now with the health specialist, you're seeing that it's written for children. I'm a parent myself, and my daughters would come home and, you know, I'd give them a portion for a meal, and one of my daughters would say, well, actually, my stomach is the size of my fist, and if you look at my fist, this is too big a portion, so can I eat this much of it? So they're being taught in a way that resonates with them as children, and so they're coming home and they're sharing that message with the adults.
Cindy, what are the biggest challenges in Anchorage and Alaska for further reducing the obesity rate among kids?
Ooh, that's we've got a lot of challenges just because of the uniqueness of our state. Obviously, the darkness is a key part in the winter, not only the darkness, but also the cold temperatures. How do you get kids physically active when it's dark and it's cold outside? So I think that's one of the key challenges. And then also affordable food. You know, it's not enough to have the free breakfasts and the free lunches. How do we make it that fruits and vegetables and milk are less expensive than chips and soda pop?
Cindy Norquist is Program Director for Healthy Futures. Norquist and the Healthy Futures Program received the 2013 President's Council on Fitness, Sports, and Nutrition Community Leadership Award.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Pilots of float planes could unwittingly be spreading a dangerous invasive weed throughout south-central Alaska. Elodia, an aquatic plant that chokes lakes and slow-running rivers, has been found in several lakes in the Anchorage area and at least one water body near Fairbanks. And authorities are warning that the plant's spread threatens irreversible harm to fish habitat. Elodia is not native to our subarctic environment, but it can survive freezing. It can also survive being swept long distances downstream, and even tiny fragments of the plant can sprout new growth. Ed Fogles, Deputy Commissioner for the State Department of Natural Resources, says earlier this year, DNR signed an agreement with the state Fish and Game and Environmental Conservation Departments to plan an attack against Elodia. Fogles says it's not certain when or where the plant was first introduced to the state.
Transmission of the Elodia into Alaska's fresh waters likely came from either somebody dumping a goldfish bowl, say, for instance, in a creek, or getting rid of some, you know, science experiment plants from their high school biology class.
The plant was documented in Eyak Lake in Cordova in the early 1980s, although no one paid much attention to it then. More recently, it was found plugging up parts of Chena Slough in Fairbanks, where it is so thick it is choking out fish habitat.
Last summer, I had the opportunity to canoe down Chena Slough near Fairbanks and look at the Elodia myself, and it was pretty dramatic. You can look down in the clear water, and you are literally canoeing on top of an inch of water on top of Elodia mats. And when you look down into the clear water, occasionally you would see gaps between the Elodia mats that were pretty deep, and you could just see fish stacked up between those mats. They really didn't want to go into the Elodia itself. It was too thick.
Elodia is thought to be the first aquatic invasive plant in the state, and fears are that its spread could impact freshwater resources and fish habitats statewide. The plant is easy to identify. It has toothy leaf edges and leaves in a circular arrangement of three or four around long, tangled stems that are a shade lighter than the leaves. Elodia has been found in Sand Lake, DeLong Lake, and Little Campbell Lake in Anchorage, all of them uncomfortably close to Lake Hood, the major float plane base in town for air carriers traveling to remote lakes all across the state for fish and hunting fly-in trips. A group of climbers that successfully retraced the 100-year-old footsteps of their ancestors have, by reaching the summit of Denali last month, have completed their long walk out to civilization. KTNA's Philip Manning spoke to some members of the climb in Talkeetna and has the story.
The Centennial Denali expedition arrived in Talkeetna late on July 3rd after retracing their ancestors' steps all the way to the top of North America. On June 28th, five men, most with direct family ties to the original 1913 summit team, made the final ascent from the Harper Glacier along with four guides from Alaska Mountaineering School. They spent half an hour on Denali's summit and then began the long trek back down. Of the six descendants who set out on the expedition, five reached the summit. Only one had ever climbed Denali before. For the rest, the total of their experience in the Alaska Range was a mountaineering course earlier in the summer. The expedition encountered very favorable weather conditions, and Alaskan-born Dana Wright explains how the fortunate weather helped them to the top.
It made it a lot easier. I mean, sometimes we see some clouds roll, and it's like, oh, here comes the storm, and then the clouds just roll right over, and then it's blue skies again. It's like, oh, okay, we're moving again, and it really made it easy for us to find a good route and made it easy for us to see all the objective hazards that were in the way. So, I mean, I couldn't ask for better conditions, and it really just up the chances for us, and so it worked out incredibly well.
Wright is a descendant of Walter Harper, the first man to ever set foot on the summit of Denali. He describes how he also became the first in his expedition to reach the 20,320-foot pinnacle.
You know, we're all on rope teams, and it was a guided expedition, but the guys that were ahead just stopped, and they're like, you know, get up there, you know, do your thing. And so it was really cool. It was an awesome summit day. We got some good photos right before the weather started socking in around us.
The most technically challenging part of the climb is Karstens Ridge, named for Harry Karstens, one of the members of the 1913 expedition. Karstens' great-grandson Ken describes the climb on the ridge that bears his family name.
The ridge itself was immaculate. In 1913, they spent weeks carving out footsteps and trying to find a route up that ridge. It was very clear. It was very obvious which way we were supposed to go. And looking out over those views, it was just incredible.
Hunter Dahlberg, one of the four guides that accompanied the expedition, says that while Karstens Ridge is the most difficult part of the expedition's route in terms of climbing difficulty, the hardest part of the trip is much closer to sea level.
The most challenging part is the walk in from the roadhead, the 20 plus miles that you walk with heavy loads to get to the glacier. And you're crossing rivers, you're swatting mosquitoes, you're, you know, doing long days on muddy trails, and then you have to do that on the way out. And the river was higher, and so, you know, that section provides the real barrier to the Muldrow route. And it often weeds out those with less intestinal fortitude.
In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Yupik artist Abayu Moore from Dillingham is leading a mural project at Anchorage's Covenant House, a shelter for homeless youth. She's painting the mural with the help of Covenant House residents over the next few weeks at the shelter's new location at 8th Street and A Street. The project was commissioned by the Bristol Bay Native Corporation in part because nearly half the youth the Covenant House serves are Alaska Native, and Moore's work often speaks to that identity. The mural features both salmon and caribou. Moore says these animals represent a subsistence way of life that prioritizes community, family, and Mother Nature.
Imagery is a really big part of the way that humans communicate and the way that they retain memory. With my murals, I try to think of us and we and try to depict what my culture has taught me. And right now, I'd like to focus on what this building is all about. It's about finding family, finding values, rooting yourself, and support. And it's really important to have a community support system, and these youth really deserve to have something beautiful to look at as a reminder, and to remind the public that this building is here and these kids need them. They need them to come in and to be the water that the youth are going through, to help them through the obstacles and help them swim.
To see an audio slideshow about Abayu Moore's Covenant House mural project, visit alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ariel Van Cleve in Soldotna, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Tony Gorman in Valdez, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Daisha Eaton and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Sarah Bernard from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every weekday. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.